Welcome back to Oncology Decoded. We are still here in Nashville at the World GU Conference in 2025. So we are fortunate to have two different guests. I've been fumbling all of our guest introductions. So Ben, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Yeah. Thanks, Manoj. And thanks. We have two wonderful guests with us. First, on my left here is Dr. Sam Cheng. He is the, I can't remember your title already, but he's a very important professor at Vanderbilt University, just down the street from us at Sarah Cannon. And then we also have Jeff Iorio with us today from Texas Oncology. He has a GU and a melanoma focus and is involved in Sarah Cannon's research program as well. So a nice community and academic vibe to this meeting. So why don't you give us your title?
So I'm the chief surgical officer at Vanderbilt Lutheran Cancer Center. I'm a urologist, and so I'm the lone surgeon in this quadrifecta. Is that correct?
I think that's the perfect terminology, and we need surgeons because we always talk about on our podcast, how do we talk more as community medical oncologists that are often separated from our urologists? How do we open up collaboration and communication? So obviously, we're trying to do that here, but obviously, we all need to do that in our own respective markets where we practice. And jumping in right in, Manoj, I know you had a lot of things you wanted to ask these two. So why don't we just go off the top of your list here?
Yeah. So I wanted to kind of break down a little bit of prostate, a little bit of bladder, and a little bit of kidney, right? So from a community sample, we face different challenges, I feel, right? And part of that is the multidisciplinary nature, right? We have broken pieces that we put together, and sometimes it becomes too fragmented,
sure,
and we face different challenges, as I'm saying. So from a prostate cancer standpoint, so we'll start there, right? So it's not often, but most oftentimes, these are patients that are generally followed by urologists, but there are patients that want to get a second opinion or want to see anything else or see what else is out there, right? And so you have these low risk, lower grade, or even favorable intermediate risk prostate cancers, so specifically like a 3+3 or a 3+4. What should we as community medical oncologists, from your perspective, and Jeff, I'm curious to know how you see this as well. What should we be looking for? How should we handle those patients?
No, I think this is a good question. Jeff, do you want to take that? Or I'm happy to talk about it because I think, to be honest, from a medical oncology standpoint, you guys have so much you have to know about. And now you're talking about an earlier stage process where things continue to evolve. It's hard. Because there are patients who will say, I want to see a medical oncologist. So, and we'll say, absolutely, but there's really not much that you all can actually offer or do, especially in that the two scenarios you raise. The 3+3 we define as low risk. If you look at the AUA guidelines, the 3+4, that pumps it up into an intermediate. We call it a favorable intermediate risk group. But the vast majority of 3+3, and that was actually discussed at the conference, is the vast majority of those patients we do surveillance, we recommend surveillance. For the 3+4, that's actually a fair number of patients. We actually also talk to them about surveillance as something that can be done safely. You try to get as much information as possible. You try to risk stratify as best you can. But clearly, you need to talk to those patients about the possibility that active surveillance may make sense.
So yeah, I think this is something I see a lot actually in clinic where people come for the second opinion because they want a medical oncology perspective. And so good to hear your side of it. And so a couple questions I'll throw in there with it, you know, these Decipher scores or other genomic scores that get mixed in, and a lot of times they're already tested by the time these patients come and see me. How much of the difference is that making in those surveillance, decisions?
Yeah, I think it's I think a lot of times the genetic tests serve as somewhat of a tiebreaker. So there are patients who are undecided who clearly want surveillance or something less aggressive, and they want as much information to say it's safe. So we look at the MRI, we look at the PSA, we look at, people talk actually about the substructure of actually the appearance of the Gleason 4 stage disease. So you look at a multitude of things. If you have a Decipher score that's way out of whack to what you expect, then those are the patients, and that's the minority of time, but those are the patients that we say, boy, we should probably explore a little bit more before we're comfortable with surveillance. Is it enough to flip them over to like, you absolutely need to have treatment? Maybe for some individuals, that's enough to say, I don't feel comfortable. But for others, it would prompt perhaps a more rapid repeat confirmatory biopsy, a repeat MRI, et cetera. So it's another piece of information, but it doesn't trump everything.
Yeah. So Jeff, thanks for asking that question. And I want to make it a little bit simpler because I like to distill those.
I am very comfortable.
How do we? As soon as you said, I want to make it simply, he looked straight at me.
I want to make sure that I'm on the right track because, you know, our community oncologists that are listening to this and watching this, they're going to see some prostate cancer, but that's, you know, the minority of what they're going to do. And to me, when I think about it, we get these second opinions as well, right? Patients have seen surgeons, they've seen radiation oncologists. Okay, now you as a medical oncologist who doesn't, quote unquote, have any skin in the game, why don't you tell me what you would recommend?
Do they look at you guys as the tiebreaker as well?
Yeah, 100%.
Yes.
And to me, when I see a Gleason 6 outside of a rare exception, which is outside of the spectrum of this podcast, I don't even think about ordering Decipher or the Artera, these new tests out there that can better stratify. It's the Gleason 3+4s. Is that an okay thing to be doing, or do we need to be ordering it in everyone?
No. Don't order it in everyone. I really don't think that's the case. Now, I say that, I'm saying majority of 3+3, I wouldn't order a test. But what about the high volume 3+3, multiple cores positive, where you know the likelihood of a 3+4 or even a 4+3 is really there? In those patients who want extra assurance, those are patients that I do extra testing, extra evaluation, because you'll have 2-4% of patients that will be enough to say, you know what, let's pursue therapy, even in that favorable quote unquote risk group. But you look at everything. You look at the PSA. You look at the patient's age, health, etc. So lots of different things. But I do agree with you, and I think in the 3+4, to me, there's really I don't want to say danger, but you've definitely increased the possibility of disease progression, not necessarily metastasis, but disease progression. If you follow those patients carefully and you've evaluated them, I think carefully, many of those patients still can be followed and have surveillance. The 4+3, I think, are our different category of patients.
So along the lines, or earlier you had said you look at MRIs.
Yes.
So PET PSMA is very available now, right? And
but not as available as we'd like. I mean, it takes a while to get a PSMA test at Vanderbilt. In town, one of the large kind of radiology practice groups are no longer doing PSMA PETs, and so it's taking us a while to get PSMA PET scans. I don't know if you've had that.
I have not had that issue, but I imagine it's just based off where our centers are and where we're referring to.
Yeah.
Right?
So we've blanketed the different radiology kind of centers in town, and we're having trouble getting it timely. But because I think we are using more PSMA PET for sure.
So I guess my question is, should these patients that are 3+4 be getting PET PSMA imaging?
Or
that's why I'm asking. Or should they be just getting the MRI to better understand? Because if you're recommending a treatment, and that's been the argument to say we should get PET PSMA imaging to figure out surgery, no surgery, but understanding where you're coming from in this context, it doesn't seem like that's something that we should be doing.
For us, within the localized disease process, okay, this is not considering metastatic disease or local regional disease, nodal disease. This is just to look at the prostate. You know, people say, oh, a very hot area on PSMA PET may be helpful for focal therapy, may be helpful for non-complete treatment of the prostate, be it radiation, complete radiation, or complete surgical removal. If you are doing it for that, it may be helpful. But if you know up front that you're going to do one of the more definitive long-term data-driven treatments, radiation, surgery, then for a 3+4, I don't find the PSMA PET very helpful at all. The MRI, which when I came back to Nashville in 2000, you know, there were very few centers doing MRIs, UCSF, Memorial. You know, we used to put up MRI images in New York when we started, and they looked like, you know, black and white TV. It was just like, how is this helpful? MRIs now are getting better and better and better, and they are helpful in surgical planning, helpful for radiation planning. The PET scan in that instance, for me personally, has not been that helpful. And I think it's a waste of money.
I guess that'd be the issue. I think was from my experience in these localized prostate cancers, I think one, getting it approved or being able to do a PET PSMA scan is usually pretty difficult. We haven't had the issue of necessarily performing the PET PSMA, but I do think that would be a limitation from my perspective at this point for that group of patients, not so much when we're dealing with potential metastatic disease and those type of patients. But I think for the localized patients, just the sheer act of getting that scan approved would be pretty hard.
So Sam, what would your advice be to your community medical oncologist for this group of patients?
The 3+4 or the 3+3?
Either one's four.
Yeah, I think from a 3+3 standpoint, you know, if I'm the medical oncologist, you basically say, look, there's nothing that I can really, there's nothing I personally can do to in any way impact your disease process without significant, there's no data and there's no significant advantage. In the 3+4, I would counsel the patient to say, look, you're in a different risk stratification group. And you may need to have careful evaluation discussion with your radiation oncologist, your surgeon, but understand that their active surveillance is also a possibility and that it will depend upon, discussions with those physicians that give localized therapy about what to do next.
I don't know. I think it puts you all in a very difficult situation because I do think that patients will turn to you, oh, should I do radiation? Should I do a focal therapy? Should I do surgery? Should I do even brachytherapy? Should I do electrocorporation? Should I do all these things that are out there? And it does, you know, open up all these things that you probably aren't as familiar with. And if I were you and I'm asked those questions, I would just say, you know, I don't really know. I don't know the data. I don't use those modalities. And, you know, you'd have to treat. And then this is up to you all as well, but maybe say, you know what? You are seeing great people, but there are other physicians that may have an expertise in those areas you may be interested in. You may need to speak to someone else.
That's the benefit of talking to all three specialties in this space.
Yeah.
All right. Shall we move on to kidney? Okay.
That's great.
So there was earlier this session, you know, early at the conference today, we were talking about what are those tumors that we can watch? You know, we're all on call at various hospitals and there might be a new kidney mass. And sometimes they're going to consult the urologist. Sometimes they're going to consult the medical oncologist, depending where you practice, right?
Okay.
So you find this new mass and we have all heard smaller tumors you can watch. Maybe they don't need a nephrectomy or a partial nephrectomy. Maybe they don't need SBRT or cryoablation or whatever techniques. And we've heard about these rules and these criteria, but we're medical oncologists and it's always a little bit out of our comfort zone to say do nothing when you might have a cancer.
Yeah.
So no, can you help demystify that for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and this is continuing to evolve for surgeons as well. This is a couple reasons why it makes it difficult to follow these patients. Historically, kidney cancer had no systemic cure. And we knew that kidney cancer has an ability to metastasize, even if it's not 12 centimeters or 15 centimeters. But if you look at the data that Dr. Perazio presented at this meeting and others that have done surveillance for a long period of time, anything less than 2 centimeters, we feel very comfortable in terms of surveillance. Why? The chance of metastasis or finding metastasis at that time is less than 1%. Secondly, it gives us an idea of, okay, we have this small lesion, less than 2 centimeters. We can then reimage in 6 months, see what the kinetics are of that mass. Because we know the smaller the mass, the less likely it is to be malignant as it is. Now, you're going to have patients who are uncomfortable. I mean, unquestionably. And so what do we offer those patients? We don't go straight to partial nephrectomy. We'll talk to patients about biopsy. We'll say, look, if we want to have an earlier idea of something and it's malignant potential or metastatic potential, we consider biopsy. We were talking earlier, Ben, about a young, healthy patient that had 2.5 centimeter. So went a little bit larger, 2.5 centimeter, you know, that is fit as a fiddle, looks like you young guys, looks great. That patient, he or she, I would talk to actually about a robotic partial removal. Most definitive, provides the cleanest idea of exactly what's going on, easy to follow, et cetera. That, not everybody agrees with that. Not everybody would do that. As those lesions get larger, the 3 to 4 and greater than 4, I think they all need treatment of some kind, be it biopsy for, this is assuming that they're healthy enough to undergo treatment.
Right, of course.
Yeah. So be it biopsy and then figure out what to do. I think we struggle a lot. We just talked about it at Tumor Board of these oncocytic neoplasms. And our pathologists feel uncomfortable going straight to oncocytoma and have switched to this low-grade oncocytic neoplasm and can't really differentiate between clear cells that may look like it, chromophores that may look like it. And so those patients sometimes can be a dilemma. But if you look at the size criteria, less than 2 centimeters, I think you feel very comfortable and tell the patient, look, there's less than 1% chance that this is going to spread. And so I think the safest thing is let's proceed with repeat imaging.
I had an interesting case I saw just a couple weeks ago, been under surveillance.
Yes.
With a urologist, did an MRI and then showed a bone lesion that was new. And then the urologist like, this seems weird because this lesion was like 2 centimeters.
Right.
And she comes and sees me and I was like, well, this does seem weird. We do a biopsy of the bone lesion.
Yes.
It's breast cancer, right? So it's totally unrelated. But you can tell in her mind, she was like,
"What did you guys?
Why have we been doing surveillance for this? You know?" And she was freaking out. Of course, unfortunately, she's got this other news. But
right.
But it's still proof of principle, I think.
No, absolutely.
Still, when I saw her, I was sort of reassuring. No, I think you've been doing the right thing. This is probably something else. Let's go figure it out. Unfortunately, it was different diagnosis.
Yeah. Right? And then I think I would tell the patients that you see with those 2 to 3, 3 to 4 centimeter lesions that there are a variety of treatments. And the data regarding cryoablation or thermal ablation of those tumors, if you look at cancer-specific survival rates at 10 years, they're the same compared to partial nephrectomy, even radical nephrectomy. Now, if you talk about recurrence rates, the recurrence rates are a little bit higher by a few percent, single-digit percentage points with thermal ablation. But my partners and I argue about this. Now I'm older. If I had a 3 centimeter, 2.5, it was in a favorable location, would I do a partial or would I do a thermal ablation? I would do a thermal ablation. And that's because I'm, you know, about 89 years old. And although I'm fit, but I'm older. I'm comfortable with, if it's in a good location, I'm comfortable with the chance of that being effective.
Yeah, and these are conversations we have with our interventional radiologists and our urologists all the time.
Yes.
At large volume hospitals in the community as well. And if it's okay, Manoj, if we shift gears to the complicated lack of data, lack of guideline, neoadjuvant space where, you know, in my clinic, we'll be on our tumor boards. Our tumor boards are unique because they cover multiple practices because we're out there in the community. And we'll have a patient that...
Yeah, I admire the fact that you're able to do a tumor board. Like, I mean...
A lot of work.
Yeah. I mean, you know, most places don't have that, which is great. It's a huge advantage for your patients.
Yes. Well, absolutely. And you know, I think we're trying to build that throughout the country. Mm-hmm. But to say we have this patient, it's a large tumor. It's going to be a complicated surgery. Maybe it's around a vessel. Maybe it's around... The surgeon just doesn't feel confident that they can clean it all with good margins in a non-risky way. Or maybe there's mild nodes attached and they want us to see if we can shrink that tumor, right? And I do this. And unfortunately, I have probably, you know, 10% of my patients may be this exact space. Why don't you treat them for 3 to 6 months? And if things look good, then we'll chop it out, right? So first of all, Jeff, is that something that happens in Texas Oncology? Do you see those patients?
Sometimes I'd say, yeah. I mean, I think it's a discussion I've had, you know, so occasional patients where we've had talked about it, pros and cons. You know, I think if it seems like they're still surgically resectable, most of the time, I think we're still not necessarily doing any neoadjuvant treatment in those particular cases. If it's something where, yeah, doesn't seem to be surgically resectable for some reason, then yeah. Adapting more to systemic treatment, but I haven't used a lot of just pure neoadjuvant treatment.
What about you, Manoj?
Yeah, I'm in your same boat. By the way, you don't need my permission to move on, but no, I'm exactly that same scenario. You know, we've talked about this before where we, you have these patients, you know, they could be sick for some other reason, yes, and trying to get over that acute illness. Sure. They're accidentally found to have this relatively larger kidney mass, right? Like it's okay, an 8-centimeter mass, but not too risky for a surgery because of a new PE that was found and you need to be on anticoagulation, can't come off of it. And so my surgeons will say, treat them for a few months,
okay,
and then we'll reassess. Or if there's an inkling based on MRI that there's this involvement of the IVC or wrapping around, as Ben was talking about, then is it, well, kid, do you give them combination, do you give them up front, and then we'll reevaluate.
So the question I have for both you folks, it seems like there are several scenarios, locally advanced disease, perhaps something where they'd want to try to do a partial whatever, and hey, do something, shrink, stabilized, make it a little bit easier. Just percentage.
Well, I mean,
percentage of times that the surgery then happens.
Oh, I would say majority of the time.
Okay.
My days. The challenge though is that I've had instances where that mass disappears. So I've had instances where I've had patients.
Well, then why the hell did the surgeon say, I need help with this? I mean, 8-centimeter tumors disappear.
I'm not saying 8 centimeters. Okay. I'm just saying, like, you know, by the time the patient's recovered from that PE, like, I'll give you a real scenario, right? So I've had a patient who had a recent PE, was saddle embolus, too risky for anesthesia. And they said, no surgery.
Sure.
But it was a 4.5-centimeter mass.
Okay.
So we ended up treating her. I gave her IOTKI.
Okay.
Because, like, well, if we're going to treat her, then I might as well just treat her as locally advanced. I probably overtreat it.
Right.
But I gave her combination therapy. 3 months goes by. I don't see a renal mass anymore.
Wow.
And so
it's aggressive.
So what do you do, right? So,
yeah, I mean, that's, I think that's a great question because if you don't do any kind of local intervention, how long do you keep them on doublet or do you go single agent? What do you do for how long? So that adds that question. I personally haven't seen, you know, localized mass, total resolution of a mass or near total resolution. I've seen some tumors, but our rule of thumb is if it's resectable safely, we tend to try to resect. Now, if it's resectable safely, but it's widely metastatic, multiple locations, we treat all those patients with systemic therapy.
Of course, right. Yeah. Right. And then, Ben, if they have a great response, do you ever do consolidative nephrectomy?
Yes, we still do. If all the, and it's, that's when we debate how long or when do we pull the
trigger. So how long do you do it at Vanderbilt?
So we wait the longest with brain and bone mets. We wait easily more than a year. But then it's a combination of, okay, how have they responded? Are they responded totally? How are they tolerating their systemic therapy? Honestly, we don't want to operate on them because we're so worried they come off or whatever. So it's that. And then how large is the renal mass that's still there? So, and is that renal mass now growing and everything else is stable? So all those kinetics come into play. And, we are aggressive surgically. Our medical oncology colleagues that we work with, they're very aggressive locally as well. But we're careful with those patients.
So I'd like to give an aside about this, and then maybe we'll move on to your Theo. But my thought is, and you seem surprised about, I mean, I was saying most of these patients are going to surgery. Well, if we look at the frontline metastatic data,
right?
If you give an IOTKI combination, your response rates are about 70 to 80%. Your primary progressive disease is about 5 to 9 to 10%, right?
Okay.
Depending on that trial. Now, if you gave ipi/nivo, say an IO therapy doublet, that would be a completely reverse.
Okay.
Right? And we all think about immunotherapy maybe more durable. I don't know if I personally believe that, but that's the teaching, right?
Okay.
But an IOTKI up front, you're not going to have a lot of escape, right? So I think that's why we feel maybe a little bit overly eager in the community sometimes doing these things when our surgeons ask, because we don't see a lot of primary progression.
No, I agree with that. I just don't know what you're in those unique situations that you're saying where we can't do surgery right now for whatever reason. Okay, I get it. But routinely, I
wouldn't say it's a routine
thing. Yeah,
I think this certainly is the 10%. Exception more.
Oh yeah, okay.
More than
I think you're, because honestly, you're doing little harm. You're now. I have issues with it when people say, "Oh, I want to make this lesion from a radical nephrectomy to a partial nephrectomy. In reality, I don't...
So hang that question, on that question. So the reason to ask that question is because of patients who have end-stage kidney disease.
Sure, absolutely.
Right? So for patients who have end-stage kidney disease and you're really trying to preserve and prevent dialysis...
Sure. This happens all the time. At least in our clinic.
This happens all the time.
No.
So how would you approach... For me, I was like, if I can give you any chance of preventing dialysis, let's do it.
Yeah. I mean, these are the ones we struggle with. Honestly, it really depends upon how the surgeons feel in terms of their confidence that they're going to be able to do a partial nephrectomy.
Sure.
And that's what it comes down to. If we're talking about, you know, it's a different story, obviously, with metastatic disease or multiple positive nodes, whatever, but you have a solitary kidney or basically a solitary functioning kidney. You have a large renal mass. The question then becomes, can you get it out? You can get it out safely. Okay, great. It is very, people write about it. The folks at Cleveland Clinic, other places talk about, you shrink it down. People at Anderson, they talk about it. And then you can do a partial. We haven't had as much luck personally and at our places being able to do that successfully and maintaining their renal function.
That's because drugs work better in the community than in academic centers.
Generally, I think. How do you guys do this? I mean, I can't disagree with what Penn's saying.
Right? No. You guys get the souped up versions. I know how it is. Okay.
We do face those scenarios all the time where you've got, you know, people who are not very good surgical candidates. Facing potential dialysis down the road. That got severe kidney failure.
Yeah, that scenario, I think it totally makes sense.
And so those are types of situations where I think, trying something like that to see if we could convert it over.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite go-to?
In that scenario?
Yeah. I mean, it's just data-free, right?
Yeah, you're right. I'm yours. I mean, probably I'd do IOTKI and do something like a Nevo-Cabo or something like that, you know, to see if we can actually get maximum shrinkage, you know, and because most of the time in metastatic disease, I'm probably more on the IO boat most of the time frontline, but if I'm thinking about some situation where I want maximum response, then I'm doing IOTKI.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or we move on to bladder. All right. What's your burning question, Manoj?
My burning question. When can I tell my patients that you don't need a cystectomy?
Okay.
Never.
I got you. I got 6 years probably practicing, maybe more. In about 7 years. No, 7 years. We're not there yet, but clearly I think that buzz has been raised because some of the systemic therapies are eliciting responses that I personally have never seen before, that medical oncologists haven't seen before. And we see the data in advanced disease. Wow, this is, you know, things that we haven't seen. And that the signal with EV is so soon after a couple of rounds, quickly if they're going to respond. So I think that at some point, what do we have to improve on? Well, we need to continue to improve our systemic therapies. Okay. All right. That's happening. Secondly, we really have to do a better job of locally assessing the bladder. And that's where we're deficient. And we Fox Chase has shown that. Other series have shown that we're really not good at really determining if that clinical T0 is truly a pathologic T0. So that's why Dr. Scarpato at the session talked about, you know, the increasing role of MRI. That's going to be important. I think that's going to be really important, but we're going to have to do MRIs prior to resections. It's going to be a complicated situation. And then to me, the whole, do we look at urine DNA? Do we look at serum ctDNA, do we look at a combination? How are we going to really determine what's going on in the bladder? A corollary to that is, don't take out the bladder, just radiate the bladder. Spare the big surgery, the diversion, et cetera. And there's unquestionably a movement towards doing more bladder-preserving therapy with combination things. So, I don't think cystectomy is gone. I think there are going to be more and more patients who are going to demand that, who are going to say, no, you're not going to take out my bladder. You just showed me the scan. It didn't have anything. It had something before.
we're just going to be very careful with patients.
So I have a kind of a dumb question that I'm going to ask, because, you know, cystoscopy is the kind of like old go-to, right? When are we going to move away from cystoscopy and go to something?
No. I mean, everything. I think your questions are excellent. They're not dumb. They're really good. I mean, that's another gold standard too. It's just like, all right, for prostate cancer, when are we going to eliminate the biopsy? You know, it was discussed, oh, do an SMA PET and do the MRI, and then we're going to know. And then Dan Barocas, one of my partners, said a really good point. We don't want to overtreat. There's just as bad with overtreatment as perhaps underappreciate what's going on. Cystoscopy, we're getting closer and closer. And I think what's going to happen is urine-based tests are going to basically be good enough to rule out. In other words, basically, we want all our true negatives to really be negative, obviously, and rule out any false negatives. And so we're getting better. And I think the urine tests are going to be a combination of probably proteins as well as genetic changes, and looking at kind of safety. And there are lots of trials going on with that.
I think that's really interesting because, you know, urologists have been giving more and more therapies, right? Well, now you're saying that we don't need cystoscopes. We can use urine-based testing. So we can do that in our clinics, right, Jeff Manoj? So exciting for the future for medical oncologists. I'm just kidding.
No. In all honesty, it should be. Why? I mean, what's, if you ask patients, but interestingly, I'm going to throw this curveball out at you. We asked patients, this is a study done when you guys were just a gleam in your father's eye, just like a long, long time ago. There are studies that were basically done looking at, all right, you're a patient. How good does the test have to be to not do a cystoscopy? It was like greater than 90% accuracy. Mm. Because they don't feel comfortable without. And so patients will discuss the fact that I don't want to have a cystoscopy, but a significant proportion of patients want that. They will ask to do it more often. They'll ask it, no, I don't want to go out to a year. I want to do it every 6 months. I want to know.
Yeah.
And the tricky thing is cystoscopy, it's our gold standard, but it's not perfect. We miss lesions, et cetera, et cetera. So cystoscopy will not go away totally, but in terms of following and maybe initial screening, I think urine-based studies are really going to at some point take over.
So I'm going to ask Jeff the question first before I ask you, okay. Sam. I'm curious to hear from a medical oncology standpoint what's actually being done in our community. And that's really looking at the non-muscle invasive bladder cancer patients, right? So these are, again...
Well, you know, she's not being doing much. No, I mean, that's what the search...
This is where the ants and frogs on.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, go ahead.
So these, again, very similar to our earlier conversation about prostate cancer, these are patients that'll come and say, well, I have bladder cancer. You do a Google search and it's like, well, you need a medical oncologist, you need a radiation oncologist, you need all these people. And, you know, hats off to my urology colleagues because they deal with that, but then the patients will still come see us. So I'm curious, Jeff, how do you approach your non-muscle invasive bladder cancer patients? And when do you say, I think it's something that I can help you with?
It's a good question. And it's the classic, we have a hammer of what do we do with it, you know, especially with the potential of things like Keytruda, you know, mix it into them, you know, into it. Now, of course, we have all these other therapies that are starting to get approved for non-muscle invasive post-BCG failures. Yeah. I mean, that's probably when I see them the most, is that post-BCG failure, occasionally right after they get diagnosed because they just want an opinion. But that's probably where I feel like I've gotten involved the most. And I think the landscape's getting trickier because we're starting to get other therapies involved. I feel like when the pembrolizumab data first came out, we were probably pretty hot and heavy to give patients pembrolizumab post BCG failure. I don't know that I'm like as quick or excited about it now that there's these other options. And so that's where I think still working with our urologist colleagues and discussing what might be best for the patient and in those particular situations.
Yeah, so I'm going to... Are you scanning them?
I mean, typically, probably not a whole lot that I'm full scanning them when they still have just non-muscle invasive disease. But
so I was going to jump in and I want to know your scan answer. What's the right answer?
I don't think there's a right answer, but I am scanning them. I'm scanning them if they have more aggressive features, right? If they have if it's noted, if it just says high grade and if they have recurrent non-muscle invasive and they've failed BCG multiple times, I'm scanning them. Because I want to know, is there something deeper? Was it a good TURBT? Like, I don't know, because that's interoperable. Like, it depends on who the urologist is, right? Nothing to discredit anybody. It's just a variation. So those patients I do scan.
And so, you know, I personally gave pembrolizumab a few times in that space. And then I've honestly, that sheen is gone. I don't love that in that space. It's not very durable. The response rates have a lot to be improved. And that's when these patients come to me, they go, oh, you're right, Sarah Cannon, can you give us all the new fancy toys? And I say, no, I can't, but I can help refer you to someone who can. So I'm going to use that word demystify one more time. And this is going to be the last question we ask.
You want my heart?
I want you. How do we explain all these new intravesical approvals from, we have the potential TARIS coming forward, we have intravesical interferon type treatments, we have viral type treatments. How do we think about that? And how many times can we switch like we switch TKIs and kidney cancer? Or if we fail one of them, do we need to move on to radiation or cystectin?
Okay, so great question. I'm shaking my head. I can't believe we've used this phrase actually probably too commonly, this embarrassment of now riches and possibilities, which we never had before, were such a dearth. And now there are options and there are attractive clinical trials and more therapies coming along. As a medical oncologist, look, these intravesical therapies, it depends on if you want to get into that business, if you want to actually start doing intravesical therapies. But if you're going to start doing that, then you have to have a relationship with someone who's going to monitor the disease.
Well, someone has to put it in. We need a urologist here. We're not trying to stick those in. I'm saying, what am I going to tell this patient to prepare for?
Ask in the community, if you give gemcitabine and docetaxel, where is that given in the community?
It's given by urology.
In the hospital.
In the academic. But there are a lot of places.
Yeah.
In practice, they can't give it.
We have infusion centers.
Not so much in our sites, but in like where I am, but in some of our much more rural communities, the med oncs are actually giving. You go down to McAllen, Texas. You go to West Texas. They're actually the ones giving intravesical.
You go outside of Tennessee, Kentucky, North Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi. Yes. They'll be, infusion centers will be giving, now, they don't like giving it, they're not set up for it, but they'll get instructions, what's the dose, et cetera, et cetera. Because the urologists don't either have the capability or the experience, whatever, using intravesical chemotherapy options. And now they have even less with these new medications that are down the line. So, you know, that's a long answer to a question that really doesn't have an answer. It's like, okay, what do I do? If I'm a medical oncologist, it really is, how active do I want to get in this field? If I don't, which I think is okay, totally acceptable, because the chance of metastasis is really low for the majority of these patients, not all. When we see T1 bladder cancer patients, I tell them they have a 10 to 15% chance of developing nodal metastases while we're not taking out their bladder. Up front, so they need to know that. Almost everybody says that's enough to proceed with trying anything other than bladder removal. So if you're not going to actively get involved, then I would say, look, I've got to defer that to my urologic colleagues. They may or may not have these new medications, but they may have clinical trials. They may have one of these medications available. I would have them see him or her and go over those.
And comparing the systemic pembrolizumab to those therapies, do you feel that those intravesical, those new drugs, have more response, more durability?
Obviously, no head-to-head comparisons have been done. And so I'll always hedge, but there's no way that single monotherapy systemic pembro is going to be better than these new agents that are being developed.
And that's my personal thought as well, though, you know, from seeing all the data.
Toxicity as well, right?
Yeah.
IV pembrolizumab versus local regional therapy within the bladder is far better tolerated.
Yeah, I didn't. Yeah, and I think safety.
Yeah.
I mean, because you're going to have side effects from the intravesical therapies, so the local side effects. But if you look at the CREST data, which combines, you know, a subcutaneous PD-1 inhibitor with BCG and compared to BCG alone, you know, there seems to be benefit. There seems to be some synergism, and that's maybe where medical oncology gets more involved, or the urology practices that are big enough to combine. But then you look at the significant treatment-related adverse events, and it's so much higher in the patients that get the systemic therapy.
I think that's great. I think we leave it at that. I think we say thank you.
Oh, thank you, guys.
Sam and Javert, this was a great conversation. Manoj, send us off with our contact information.
Yes, please. Thank you all for listening, and thank you, our guests, for joining us and having this conversation with us. Please follow us on X at Oncology Decoded and reach out to us at podcasts@oncologydecoded.com. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Thanks for having us.